Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer and this is The War of Independence, Part 11, Women and the Irish Revolution. This episode is something different to the shows in the War of Independence series to date. As the story develops, I'll be doing interviews with experts on specific aspects of the war, which will help deepen our understanding of the conflict. In the first of these, I'm delighted to have Liz Gillis on the show to look at how women played a key role in the Irish Revolution. Now, while numerous Irish women, from revolutionaries to unionists, have been covered in the series to date, this fascinating interview with Liz provides a wider context and looks at how women helped to establish Ireland's revolutionary movement, and then how many women, although often overlooked in later histories, played essential roles in the conflict. Well, this is all ahead of us. I have a quick update on a question that I've been getting lots of inquiries about over the last few months, and that's about my books. So if you've only started listening to the show recently, you might not be aware that I've written two books. Now, the first of these was published in 2013 and is on life in medieval Ireland, and has lots of fascinating chapters on individual aspects of medieval life, from things like sex, politics and war. Now, this has been out of print for a while, and the price online has gone off the charts, to the point that I couldn't afford to buy my own book. At the time of writing this, there was even a copy of the first edition on sale for £130. Now, I really hope no one buys that copy. It's not only an obscene amount of money, but I wouldn't even see a cent of it. In some good news, though, I have copies of a second edition paperback available in the shop at irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop. That's irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop. Now, these are much more reasonably priced at just €13.99, and they'll be signed by yours truly. There's only 20 copies of the book available in the shop, so get yours now at irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop. Now to the interview. I began by asking Liz to introduce herself.
My name is Liz Gillis, and thanks a million, Finn, for having me on the show. And I'm an historian, and I'm the author of six books about the Irish Revolution. So I've written a book about the women, and I've co-written a book about the women. So the photograph book that I did is called Women of the Irish Revolution. That was by Mercer Press.
Liz then went on to give an overview of women's position in wider Irish society at the turn of the 20th century.
Yeah, so supposing your class meant what status you had and what your position would be in society. Obviously, with upper middle class women and, you know, the well-to-do, some had access to university. Thankfully, university was opened up to women at that stage, towards the end of the 19th century. But a lot of them were doing philanthropic work. They were involved in the local boards of workhouses and so on. So there had been changes made for women to be active in political life. But those women would be women from upper class or upper middle class background.
One organisation that women were increasingly involved with was the Gaelic League, an organisation founded by Irish nationalists to promote the Irish language, history and culture. Liz explains how working class women, effectively barred from education, were involved in the Gaelic League and how it became a key building block in the revolutionary movement.
The working class women weren't out working. You know, education was nothing to them. Except the exception would be the Gaelic League. And the Gaelic League is crucially important to educating women, not in terms of, you know, furthering yourself, but in educating them in terms of the Irish history, the culture, the language, the heritage. And that all ties in with the revolutionary movement. Girls from, say, a middle-class background would go into teaching and so on. And at the turn of the century, obviously, you have the suffragist movement. And they would be, you know, the women who had led the way there would be Anna Haslam and Isabella Todd. And, you know, fighting for the rights for women to get the vote and so on. But not all women, women of a certain class. But then following on from that, you have the younger generation of suffragettes, Hannah Shee Skeffington and Margaret Cousins and so on, who were Republican minded or nationalist minded, but feminism was their main priority. And then this beacon of activism that is Maud Gonne emerges. In 1900, well, she'd been active since the 1880s, but she is the linchpin that joins all of these different strands together, because she was the daughter of a British officer who was stationed in the west of Ireland in the 1880s at the height of the land war. And Maud Gonne had witnessed an eviction, and that's the moment she becomes politicised and gets so involved in Irish political movements. She was involved in the amnesty campaign for the Fenian dynamiters, Tom Clark and so on, that were being treated horribly in prison in England. And although she was a member of certain groups, she was ostracised from a lot of groups because she was a woman. But Maud Gonne was just a force to be reckoned with. And she set up a Nina na HÉireann and Daughters of Ireland in 1900. And they were a militant Republican group of women. These weren't hiding behind any doors. They weren't, you know, nationalists. They didn't want just, you know, to be part of the British Empire. They wanted to be completely separate from the British Empire. And that group brought together women like Cliona Maloney, Countess Markovitch was a member. You have working class women beside those of the upper middle class or middle class women. And that organisation, it ticks so many boxes because it takes in feminism, it takes in republicanism predominantly, socialism. There's a real sense of social justice with these women. And they set up schools in the North Nair City for the boys and girls of the poorest places in Dublin, because there was no future for them. No one was providing a future for those kids. They saw that education was power, so educate those children.
This educational work, carried on by Inní na hÉireann, was crucial. And the spelling of this organisation is difficult. You can find it in the notes below this show. But as Liz now explains, this educational work was crucial after the founding of another organisation called na Fianna Éireann. Founded in 1909, this organisation for teenage boys was where many Republican leaders began their political activism, and the fact that they had been educated and influenced by Inní na hÉireann was crucial.
Countess Markovitch in 1909 then co-founds na Fianna Éireann with Bulmer Hobson. You have this relationship because some of the boys that would have been taught by these women join na Fianna Éireann. So the two most important groups, and I would argue the reason you have a Republican movement at all in the 20th century, because remember the IRB was defunct pretty much at this stage, is because of Inní na hÉireann. Then that link with na Fianna, who become the officers of the Irish Volunteers when they're set up in 1914, na Fianna, who had all of that history behind them. So from one group, you have, I would argue, all of this emerging and amazing women and the sense of social justice. And I will say this time and time again, the sense of social justice never, ever, ever left the women, because they knew what they were fighting for. They had a very clear vision of what the New Ireland was they wanted, in that, and it's not taken away from the men, but it's like, what was the it was once said that, the men was like, you know, when a dog chases a car, and he's just focused on chasing the car. And then he gets the car. Then I was like, what's he going to do? But the women knew that if they get this new Ireland, it is an Ireland where man, woman and child will matter. It will be equal rights for everyone. And the poorest will be looked for after and given opportunities. And that's what they were fighting for. And you see that the women, it never, ever leaves the women. That goal. And it is sort of realised in print with the 1916 proclamation.
While women were becoming increasingly active in politics in the early 20th century, Liz now explains how this provoked different reactions from different movements. For example, home rulers, traditionally much more conservative, were hostile to women getting involved in politics, while Republicans, who had worked alongside women, were much more supportive.
And definitely the Home Rule movement, the Irish Parliamentary Party, women weren't going to have a place if Ireland got Home Rule. And when you've got the likes of Hannah Shee Skeffington, who is a suffragette, who was is being arrested with her comrades for her activities, while her father, who is a member of the Irish Parliamentary Party, is advocating, no, there is no vote for women. You can see that tension. You can imagine that tension. Imagine what, dinner time would be like in that house. But within the Republican movement at that time, then the difference within the Republican movement, you don't have that tension. That comes later. If you consider that and you can't sort of underplay the importance of the Gaelic League, because the Gaelic League was responsible in bringing men, like-minded men and women together, who then became those revolutionaries. So they've got things in common and they're all doing the same thing. They're all having the same conversations.
The newspaper of Inné na hÉireann was particularly important in building these links between men and women.
They had a newspaper, Ban na hÉireann, and Countess wrote for it, and Helena Maloney was the editor, because Maud Gonne was in France at this stage. But I'm paraphrasing here, but it was the newspaper that young men read, because all of these future revolutionaries, they'd be going into, Tom Clark's shop and so on, and they'd be all reading this newspaper. Because while you had gardening tips in, you also had militant Republican, tones. The women didn't hold back on what they were actually saying and what they were advocating for. So you do have a lot of close relationships developing thanks to organisations like the Gaelic League. And then when the time came, they would be side by side.
The most famous and arguably most important women's organisation was Cumann na mBan. It was founded in the midst of the Home Rule crisis in the years before the First World War. As covered in episode 1 of the War of Independence series, from 1912 onwards, it seemed Ireland would receive increased autonomy in the form of Home Rule. As Liz explains, this led to a militarisation of politics in Ireland with the founding of the Ulster Volunteers to oppose Home Rule with force, and then the Irish Volunteers to support Home Rule. Many of the women Liz has already talked about were instrumental in setting up Cumann na mBan, a women's organisation to support Home Rule, but would go on to play an important role in the 1916 Rising and then the War of Independence itself.
Yeah, so Cumann na mBan, the Irish Women's Council, so that was set up officially on the 2nd of April 1914. Now, a lot had changed with 1912. So you had finally Home Rule would be put in the statute books. So Ireland would get some form of independence, say a couple of years to come into effect. And pretty much immediately in response to that, you have the formation of the Ulster Volunteer Force in Ulster. Basically, Edward Carson and his supporters taking up arms or threatening to take up arms to fight the British government if they tried to make Ulster leave Britain or be part of United Ireland. Now, no one was looking out for Home Rule. And there was always eyes down here watching what was happening up in Ulster. So it was decided that, well, if there's someone, set up, this organisation set up to basically destroy Home Rule, there should be someone to protect Home Rule. So you have the formation of the Ulster Volunteer Force down here, nationwide organization, hugely, hugely popular. Now, Inanna was in Dublin. And because you have this now nationwide male organization, it pretty much decided, let's go nationwide. Let's set up a nationwide women's organization to help with this. So Cumann na mBan was founded in Wynn's Hotel on the 2nd of April 1914. Now, the thing is, Inanna didn't go away. Inanna became a branch of Cumann na mBan. So Cumann na mBan was set up along the lines of branches, and you would have a president, a secretary, a treasurer, and so on. There was one militant branch of Cumann na mBan, and that was the Inanna branch. And they set themselves up along the same lines as the volunteers, in that they had a commandant, a vice commandant, and an adjutant and section leaders and so on. And what you find with that group is that they and the women of the Irish Citizen Army are the dominant militant groups in 1916, those two little groups, because it was only a small group of women. There was a bit of tension then within the ranks of the women, because some women argued that the Cumann na mBan were just an auxiliary to the volunteers, that they were just going to be, in a supporting role. But there were others that argued, no, we're more than that. And, as history proved, the women were more than that. And we do have that tension from the start, and certainly at the start, it is said that they are an auxiliary movement. But again, without Cumann na mBan, you could not have had the volunteers and later the IRA just simply could not have done what they did in either 1916 or the War of Independence. And the women proved that they were well more than just supporters of the Republican movement.
The 1916 Rising, covered in episode 2 of the series, was a pivotal moment in terms of building Ireland's revolutionary movement. This insurrection saw armed rebels seize key buildings across Dublin, leading to a week of bitter fighting with the British Army. And Liz now explains how women were involved in this revolt.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, the famous saying is the only made sandwiches. And even that, that proved to be so crucial. So what you had was another organization that we just didn't mention, or I mentioned briefly, was the Irish Citizen Army. And they are so important because the Irish Citizen Army set up in 1913 November. That was unique in that men and women were members. Now, James Connolly, he believed that the women should be trained in the use of arms, and not that they were to be fighting beside the men when the fight came. It was that if something did happen to the front line, as in the men, some would have to continue the fight, and that would be the women. And in the Irish Citizen Army, for so many women, they go, this is the organisation I've been looking for everything. It brings everything together. So you have got trade unionism, socialism, feminism, the republicanism, everything. So you find then that women like Countess Markovitch, Helena Maloney, a lot of Inanna women then become members of the Irish Citizen Army as well. So when it comes to 1916, two women were promoted to the rank of officer before the Rising, and they were Countess Markovitch and Kathleen Lynn, and both for the Irish Citizen Army. Kathleen Lynn served in City Hall, and Countess Markovitch, of course, was in Stephen's Green. She wasn't meant to be there, but because of the countermanding order that, caused so much confusion and, so few turned out, Michael Mallon, who was in charge there, needed all hands on deck. Countess Markovitch was very adept at, she could fire a gun, no problem. She'd been taught by Margaret Skinner, who was also in the College of Surgeons, and Countess was able to organise and so on. And the other branches of Cumann na mBan, they were delegated to go to serve with the different outposts in the city centre. So in the general post office, you have women mainly from the central branch of Cumann na mBan, because again, when the countermanding order had been given cancelling the manoeuvres for the Sunday, then the women find out on the Monday that there actually is going to be something happening. So some of them went to where they could, the GPO is the main focal point. You have Winifred Kearney. She was the only woman to actually set off from Liberty Hall with the headquarters garrison who would occupy the GPO. She marches off with James Connolly and Pierce and Tom Clark and so on. And he said she was armed with a typewriter in one hand and revolver in the other. The other two groups that left from Liberty Hall, the Citizen Army, one half go and take over City Hall, the other half go to Stephen's Green. Kathleen Lynn and Countess Markovich, in the meantime, are driving around delivering supplies and so on. And Countess Markovich arrives at St. Stephen's Green after the policeman was shot. It has been said she's been blamed on shooting that policeman at Stephen's Green. She wasn't there. She was driving around the city with Kathleen Lynn.
Next, Liz explains how these women were crucial in maintaining morale amongst the rebels. She explained this by comparing the fate of the one rebel garrison without any women, that of Boland's Mills, with the rebels in the Marrowbone Lane distillery.
In Boland's, a number of men did have breakdowns because they hadn't been under fire, like never been in this situation before. But you compare that to Marrowbone Lane distillery, where the women are the eyes of the volunteers because they were spotting for the volunteers where the soldiers were coming. They're keeping up the spirits of the men. So even when it looks like at the surrender, when they're defeated and it's all over, the women were told to go and they said no, refused to leave the men. They'd been with them all week. They'd stay with them all week. Don't care what happens to them. And as they're being marched down to the point of surrender near Patrick's Park, the men were throwing away their guns. The girls are picking them up and hiding them in their skirts. When they get to the Ross Road, the British soldiers tell them, "We're going to search us. We know you have guns." They still refuse to give up the guns and carry them, smuggle them into Richmond Barracks. But as they're then being brought up to Richmond Barracks, being marched through the Liberties, and, you know, hostile crowds and stuff, the women were singing at the top of their lungs, "God save Ireland." And so you've got what looks like a defeated army. But the sound and the imagery of these women who, you know, no one had ever seen anything like this before. And there they are marching proudly. And what that was showing was, you may have won this battle, but the war is yet to come. And we're going to be part of that war.
As has been covered in the series, the Republican movement re-emerged stronger than ever in the aftermath of the 1916 Rising, and the War of Independence began in 1919. Liz now details the role women played in the War of Independence.
So, yeah, you have, there was a very, I suppose, it wasn't that women were to be on the front line, say, fighting with the men in the battles, but it doesn't underestimate the work that the women had to do because it was essential to the whole Republican movement. So the War of Independence was a guerrilla conflict between the IRA and the Crown Forces. But the support network that was needed was crucial. Intelligence. The women were fantastic at intelligence. And like Michael Collins, like the spies that he had everywhere was unbelievable. You had postmistresses, like in the post office around the country, that were, you know, intercepting letters coming in, telegrams coming in, passing them on to the IRA. You had girls working in banks. One girl, I'll give you, Jenny Cleary, and she worked in the Munster and Leinster Bank in town. And men were coming in to deposit money into their bank account. They weren't. There was they passed in the bank book, but there was nothing in the bank book except maybe intelligence, or if they were on the run, a letter home. And she passed that on to the intelligence officer. And then if word had to be given back, then, you know, they'd come back in to, you know, deposit money, and there was no money being passed through that bank book. You have the likes of Molly O'Reilly and so on that were members of Cumann na mBan or the Citizen Army, but were working in restaurants around the city, and they're listening to the conversations and gathering the information. The women were everywhere, and the IRA have been called an invisible army, but the women were the invisible army because the authorities had not got a notion as to who they were and what they were doing. like, right, you've got your high, your big names like Countess Margaret, and she was in our prison at this time, and, you know, those who had been on the radar in 1916, but it was a whole undercurrent of women that didn't know anything about. And then you've got the women that had been members of Common Man, but then were told, no, leave, because there can't be a paper trail on you. There can't be any suspicion. And one of them would be Josie Stallard, who was like Cattle Brewer's aide. And she was gathering information for him. She was trained to be a doctor, like, you know, in the Cuam Hospital. And she was travelling with him to England. She was, you know, working with Liam Clark, her future husband. And so you've got all of that support. And then one woman that stands out is, of course, Linda Cairns. Not for of just like as in what she did, but primarily amongst the volunteers because she had a car. And, you know, who had a car back in those days? You know, very few people, but what women had cars back in those days? But Linda Cairns was a nurse. And now it's later on in the War of Independence, but she was, you know, basically providing her car to the volunteers, not just to transport volunteers, but also to transport weapons. And she was arrested as a result and received a 10-year prison sentence. You've got the scouts with the ambushes, first aid, propaganda, the Irish Bulletin. Oh my God, that couldn't be imprinted about the women. Like, you know, okay, Erskine Childers and Desmond Fitzgerald, they were the directors of publicity, and they're the ones that are responsible for the creation of the Irish Bulletin, the Republican news sheet to counter what was being said in the sort of mainstream press. But that was collated by the women. It was printed by the women. Kathleen McKenna Napoli, you know, she, her and another girl, they single-handedly pretty much printed this on their own. Often in our home, our house was raided. They had to do it in the freezing cold because they couldn't, you know, alert to anyone to the fact that they were renting an office and it could be raided. So you've got all of this work. And then, of course, the general thing of providing safe houses, looking after, like, you know, 30 men that rock up to your house and, you know, feed them and make sure that they're safe. And then, God forbid, if there was a bloody ambush, and the reprisals were becoming, and they'd be coming to your door, and you had all that to put up with. So this is what the women were doing. It's not just one thing, one aspect. The women were involved in everything, and it was all crucial, all crucial.
Finally, while it jumps ahead of where the main series has reached, I wanted to ask Liz about the lives of these women after independence. The Irish Free State was a deeply conservative place, and women were very much second-class citizens, something enshrined in both the 1922 and 1937 constitutions. Liz addressed this by looking at the ideals of the 1916 proclamation that contained many of the aspirations of these revolutionary women, and how it was enacted or ignored after independence.
So the 1922 Free State Constitution actually gave suffrage to everyone over the age of 21. So that was one aspect of the proclamation realised. It's pretty much the only one in terms of the women. And that little glimmer of hope, it didn't last very long. Now, I am no advocate of Eamon de Valera and you know, the 1927 Constitution. However, de Valera wasn't the only one. Dev hits the final nail in the coffin in terms of women in Ireland and their position in society. It was started with W.T. Cosgrave and Kevin O'Higgins way back in 1924. They started with the Juries Act, where Kevin O'Higgins wanted to take women. He wanted actually women not to sit on juries. There was huge, huge reaction to this from women who had been on the pro-treaty side and the anti-treaty side. They came together to go, hang on a minute, you ain't going to do this. And the way he got around it, he then put it that women could apply to be exempt, or if women wants to be on a jury, they could apply to be on a jury. Now, what woman was going to do that? So you can see this chipping away, and it starts very early on. And what it basically means is, okay, you may have the vote, you may think you're a citizen, but you're a second-class citizen. And it's gas when you look at it, right? The two groups that I would argue are responsible for that Republican movement that got so much, you know, between those years 1900 and 1923. Inanna na Héireann / Cumann na Mban, and na Fianna. And who are the two groups that really suffer in the new Irish state? The women and the kids. And what you see then with the women themselves, although they're excluded from big politics, like some do go into home, some do, because again, a lot of women saw the revolution as part of their life, but not their life. And they went into the role of being a mother because, you know, look, there's nothing wrong with being a mother. And if you can raise a decent family and, you know, against all these fucking, you know, difficulties and so on, fantastic. Because a lot of women were traditional in that sense. And there's nothing wrong with that. But women who were involved in politics, although ostracized from big politics, they were involved in local politics. And then some became senators. So you do have the likes of Lou Kennedy and then Nora Connolly, James Connolly's daughter. And I was only discovered this last week, the week before. Nora Connolly, and thank God she was around. So Nora Connolly had to beg for a pension, right, for our military service pension. The daughter of James Connolly, who marched up and down, marched from Tyrone down to pretty much Dublin in 1916, did all that she did in the Rising. And she had to write begging letters to prove what she had done in the revolution. But she was appointed a senator by Eamon de Valera. And there was a bill put before, there was a bill that the church put forward that they wanted to get juvenile girls, so girls who were troublesome, that they wanted to have the right to put them into the Magdalen laundries. Nora Connolly blocked that. So although the women aren't in big politics, like it's 1979 before we have our next minister, Countess Markovitch, 1919, Minister for Labour, Maura Geoghegan Quinn, 1979, like, but you had the women in local politics and in other arenas that were able to do an awful lot. So they were there. And with a lot of them, Elizabeth O'Farrell, 1916, who took the surrender to General Lowe, like she never recognised the state. You know, you don't have a paper trail on Elizabeth O'Farrell. You've got one, a little pamphlet, it's her story that she dictated to somebody. But that's all you'll have on Elizabeth O'Farrell. Others didn't recognise the state because it was not the state that they fought for and they suffered for.
I'd like to thank Liz for her time. Sound on today's episode was by Jason Looney. In the next show, the series switches focus to Ulster and looks at how sectarianism shaped the War of Independence in the north and led to intense violence in the cities of Derry and Belfast in the summer of 1920. Finally, don't forget to get a copy of my first book at irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop now. As I mentioned at the start, there's only 20 copies there, so it's worth getting yours today. Until next time, slán.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.